speaking at the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park. His 13-year-old sister's diary has been published as a book. It's called Yoko's Diary, The Life of a Young Girl in Hiroshima During World War II. Special thanks to Naoko Koizumi for translating our interview and Makiko Nakano of Democracy Now! Japan, as well as John Hamilton and Dennis Moynihan. If you'd like to see our 3 days of coverage from Japan, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is hiring. We have an opening for an on-air graphic designer and CG operator. Visit democracynow.org for more information. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Honey Masood, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Mike DeFilippo, as well as Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, Hugh Grand, Jessica Lee, John Wallach, and Vestica Dars. Also thanks to Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland. We do invite your calls at 503-231-8187.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Drones in Oregon, Myths, Facts, and Futures, a community forum about the use of drones. This community forum on the use of drones will take place Thursday, August 7th from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, Southwest 12th and Salmon in Portland. Speakers include retired Army Colonel Ann Wright, Brian Whiteside, Peter Lumsdain, and Oregon State Representative Jennifer Williamson. Again, that's Drones in Oregon, a community forum on Thursday, August 7th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. More information at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Interested in solar power? In saving the planet and money on your electricity bill? In creating millions of good jobs? Celebrate the just-completed solar power electricity installation at the Musicians Union Hall on Sunday, August 17th, from 3 to 7 p.m. You'll have a chance to see the rooftop solar unit. Learn about how you can do it on your home or business. There will be food, children's games, displays, and lots of music from the likes of Dave Rovix. Again, that's Sunday, August 17th, from 3 to 7 p.m. at the Musicians Union Hall, 320 Northeast 20th in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Again, sun is on my face, solar panels in place,
catching solar rays. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
It's okay. And good morning. You are listening to Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. And that was Jethro Tull. Boy, oldie but goodie. That's from the album Stand Up and the song Nothing Is Easy. Ain't that the truth? So I'm going to continue talking along kind of the same lines in the last several programs I've been doing. I had kind of taken off from this pamphlet or zine called We Are All Very Anxious, Six Theses on Anxiety and Why It Is Effectively Preventing Militancy and One Possible Strategy for Overcoming It. Hadn't really reached that one possible strategy yet, so I did want to give at least one more program to talking about the tail end of this zine and various other things. Kind of the theme basically is that you know, we all get so much information. People who listen regularly to KBOO, there's just a lot of information about everything that is going on in the world, from Gaza to Fukushima to climate change to the police state to, and you all know it, people who, you know, you listen to KBOO, I tend to say that people who do listen to community radio and KBOO tend to be more aware of what's going on generally in the world than people who don't. I think that's fair to say, not to pat ourselves on the back or anything, but we do really try hard to look squarely at what is going on and not to flinch and not to avoid it and not to deny it and to try to confront it. And we do try to encourage thought, discussion, and action, because thought without action tends to be paralyzing. But at the same time, not just any action is effective. And sometimes we do need to kind of step back and think a little more deeply, not just about what's going on, but about what's going on within ourselves that can tend to be obstacles towards acting effectively, not just, you know, acting for large-scale social change, but, you know, acting effectively in our relationships, just in our daily lives. You know, these things are important. We don't want to get caught up too much in looking at the big picture. And that's what this, I think this zine tends to do that fairly well. It provokes a lot of, it seems to resonate with a fair number of people. A number of people actually took the trouble to come into KBOO and pick up a copy of it. I'm sure a number of people have read it online. It's not too difficult to find. It's republished by Crime Think. It came out of the UK. It's by a group called the Institute for Precarious Consciousness. I'm not sure if they're like a formal organization or something else. In any case, you know, just the whole issue of, you know, this, are the obstacles, as they say, the obstacles to effective action and also effective thought. Because sometimes, you know, we get caught up in these patterns of thinking that may not necessarily be the most effective ones. And that's a really hard thing, you know, to deal with. It's like we all tend to develop. I always felt this really... It's really a precious thing to gain a perspective that gives you some sort of ability to understand what's really going on under the surface of the world, this world that's so heavily mediated by large structures of media organizations and advertising and all that, and to see through the superficial level. And, you know, once you gain some sort of perspective, whether it's a Marxist perspective or an anarchist perspective or a feminist perspective or whatever kind of perspective you feel, you know, you feel is sort of the main kind of key towards understanding the world that we live in. Sometimes, you know, that tends to develop these structures that also can become somewhat rigid, can, you know, not keep up to what's really going on with the world. So I don't know, it always helps to look at other perspectives and listen to other people to really, yeah, listening is really key. Being a good listener is very important, always felt. Of course, I'm here in the driver's seat, so to speak, talking at you. But, you know, talk radio, what I'm really trying to do with talk radio is really to encourage more of a continuing conversation so that we can, you know, we have such a culture of individualism, such a culture of being kind of on our own little worlds. And, you know, the places where people used to get together and talk passionately together tend to be disappearing. The public square, the town council meeting, the mythical New England town council, you know, even bar cafe culture, there doesn't tend to be as much, you know, social political discussion where people really get together. So this is, you know, talk radio is one place for it. Community radio is really, I think, a really valuable resource. I don't necessarily like that word all that much, but it's a place where we can share ideas, get together and communicate. So that's the spirit in which I bring this program to you. And as Steve said, the number is 503-231-8187. I really would like to encourage people who, you know, for whatever reason, haven't felt that strongly, the desire to, the urge to dial that number and call up and get on the airs. I really encourage you. I'd like to say that people who are regular callers to talk radio, to just step back. I don't know if you've heard this terminology, step up, step back. It's pretty common in current activist culture. It means, you know, people who are a little shyer, a little more reticent, you know, maybe just culturally haven't had much experience in putting your voice out there, engaging yourself. And, you know, I really encourage you to step up. And for the other people who are a little quicker to the draw, tend to call in and get your voice on the air. Not that we're, you know, nothing wrong with that. We definitely, that's what this show is all about. It's what talk radio is all about. But just maybe step back a little bit, let other people, encourage other people to get a chance to, you know, because some people just need a little more time. You know, some people, you know, there's especially men in our culture tend to, you know, jump in. You know, we all had that experience. We're in meetings. Tends to be, you know, white males who tend to do a lot of the talking. So just like to encourage people to take that, keep that in mind, step up, step back, this program. So, you know, if you've read this zine and you've thought about it, please call in, but it's not obligatory. I'm going to go over a little bit again very briefly. That basically the main point of this is that basically, the first line is, each phase of capitalism has its own dominant reactive affect. And affect basically means emotion, bodily disposition, or way of relating. You know, we tend to think of capitalism as a economic system, a structure of economic and power relations, decision-making over important economic decisions, and of course those are political decisions, of course, because they affect our social life. But that's not the only point. It's not just classes, it's not just corporations, it's not just the relationship between government policy and economics, it's not just structures. You know, also it affects the, you know, our emotional life, our bodily life. And that's equally important. So they basically say that there have been three major phases of capitalism, looking at it in this way, that first it was the dominant affect was boredom, and that's, you know, talking about the 1950s, people think of that, you know, and contemporary resistance is the 1960s, basically a wave of resistance was born out of that, and that capitalism largely absorbed the struggle against boredom. And then there's been a partial recuperation of this struggle. Capitalism pursued the exodus into spaces beyond work, creating the social factory, a field in which the whole society is organized like a workplace. Precarity is used to force people back to work within an expanded field of labor, now including the whole of the social factory. I made a mistake. The first dominant affect was misery, which is more like the initial period, at least in the United States, of capital accumulation, large factories, the immiseration of the working class, the whole factory system. And the reaction to that was basically large social organization, the rise of the union movement, basically the increase in wages, kind of that led into the whole social contract coming out of the 1930s, which is basically this kind of social peace, which led to the welfare state and the safety, so-called safety net, increases in wages. And then the second period was what the authors of this piece called the dominant affect of boredom. And this is all very oversimplified, but it's just an interesting way to look at things. So the 1960s is kind of born out of that. And then they say that in contemporary capitalism, the dominant reactive affect is anxiety. And they say that these dominant affects basically are effective because they are public secrets. They are effective in terms of quelling dissent because they're public secrets that we don't publicly acknowledge that's what's going on. So today's public secret is that everyone is anxious. Anxiety is spread from its previous localized locations, such as sexuality, to the whole of the social field. All forms of intensity, self-expression, emotional connection, immediacy, and enjoyment are now laced with anxiety. It's become the linchpin of subordination. One major part of the social underpinning of anxiety is the multifaceted, omnipresent web of surveillance, the NSA, closed-circuit TV, performance management reviews, the job center, the privileges system in the prisons, the constant examination and classification of the youngest school children. But this obvious web is only the outer carapace. We need to think about the ways in which a neoliberal idea of success inculcates these surveillance mechanisms inside the subjectivities and life stories of most of the population. We need to think about how people's deliberate and ostensibly voluntary self-exposure through social media, visible consumption, and choice of positions within the field of opinions also assumes a performance in the field of the perpetual gaze of virtual others. We need to think about the ways in which this gaze inflects how we find, measure, and know one another as co-actors in an infinitely watched perpetual performance. This is very dense reading. I would really recommend people either pick up a copy here or look it up online. It's called We Are All Very Anxious. It's very easy to Google that and find a copy. So I've already read much of this. I kind of wanted to get, as I said, towards the end that I hadn't got to yet, and maybe you hadn't even heard this, so this is new to you, but I think you kind of get a sense of where we're going with this. So they say anxiety is personalized in a number of ways, from new right discourses blaming the poor for poverty to contemporary therapies which treat anxiety as a neurological imbalance or a dysfunctional thinking style. 100 varieties of management discourse, time management, anger management, parental management, self-branding, gamification, offer anxious subjects an illusion of control in return for ever greater conformity to the capitalist model of subjectivity. And many more discourses of scapegoating and criminalization treat precarity as a matter of personal deviance, irresponsibility, or pathological self-exclusion. I hope we can all recognize ourselves in this. I certainly do. Many of these discourses seek to maintain the superstructure of Fordism. Fordism, of course, was the mass production model, not just the mass production model, but the the basically time management, basically isolating each form of the each stage of the production process, and making people more and more adapt to the rhythm of the machine and the mechanized workplace. So the superstructure of Fordism is nationalism and social integration. Without its infrastructure, a national economy, welfare, and jobs for all, which basically are kind of gone out the window with extreme neoliberalism and all that. Basically, the end of the social contract coming out of the 1930s as we know it. Doctrines of individual responsibility are central to this backlash, reinforcing vulnerability and disposability. Then there's a self-esteem industry, the massive outpouring of media telling people how to achieve success through positive thinking, as if the sources of anxiety and frustration are simply illusory. These are indicative of the tendency to privatize problems, both those relating to work and those relating to psychology. Earlier we argued, the authors of this zine called We Are All Very Anxious, that people have to be socially isolated in order for a public secret to work. This is true of the current situation in which authentic communication is increasingly rare. Communication is more pervasive than ever, but increasingly communication happens only through paths mediated by the system. Hence, in many ways, people are prevented from actually communicating, even while the system demands that everyone be connected and communicable. People both conform to the demand to communicate rather than expressing themselves, and self-censor within mediated spaces. Similarly, affective labor does not alleviate anxiety. It compounds workers' suffering while simply distracting consumers. Researchers have found that requirements on workers to feign happiness actually cause serious health problems. The volume of communication is irrelevant. The recomposition, reconnection of liberatory social forces will not happen unless there are channels through which the public secret itself can be spoken. In this sense, people are fundamentally more alone than ever. It is difficult for most people, including many radicals, to acknowledge the reality of what they experience and feel. Something has to be quantified or mediated, broadcast virtually in parentheses, or for us to be already recognized as political, to be validated as real. The public secret does not meet these criteria, and so it remains invisible. And their number six, second to last heading in this pamphlet, is headlined, Current Tactics and Theories Aren't Working. We need new tactics and theories to combat anxiety. And this might be a stimulating subject of conversation here, because I know there's a lot of people who have lots of different ideas about on tactics, theories, and strategies. And we don't get enough of a chance to talk about them together. It tends to be within particular activist groups or particular political groups. Or, you know, when Occupy came, that was an opportunity. That was really the promise of Occupy, was it really recreated the plaza, the public space where people could get together, you know, the General Assembly, and brought people together and gave people a chance to discuss. Unfortunately, you know, where I experienced it mostly, I was in D.C. at the time, so I was involved with someone, D.C. Occupy. I didn't really get involved here in Portland, but from what I heard around the country, you know, a lot of the same problems as ever, sectarianism, you know, certain dysfunctionality, you know, people falling back on their ideological, personal ideological perspectives or group ideological perspectives kind of came into conflict. And we really didn't get a chance as much as we need to work through the stuff at greater depth and with greater continuity. So in the spirit of that, that's why I bring you this program and talking about this particular zine. So the number, as we said, is 503-231-8187. If you've thought about this, if you're stimulated by what I've been reading and talking about, if you've read this or read other things that talk about similar ideas, please give us a call and join in this conversation, this public dialogue. So Until someone calls, I will continue reading from this pamphlet. During periods of mobilization and effective social change, people feel a sense of empowerment, the ability to express themselves, a sense of authenticity and de-repression or disalienation, which can act as an effective treatment for depression and psychological problems, a kind of peak experience. It is what sustains political activity. Boy, I can attest to that. I mean, when I got involved in Earth First back in the mid to late 80s, it was that was kind of my baptism in activism. It was a really, really amazing time where, you know, small groups of people were getting together to, you know, block logging roads and climb trees and occupy public offices. And just that feeling of bonding together and just the feeling of engaging with, you know, the power structures and doing it in really new and creative ways was really a peak experience. I mean, this, you know, then people tend to, you know, there's the whole phenomenon of action junkies. You know, you kind of keep doing it for that high, and maybe you tend to get locked into just doing actions and not spending enough time thinking about these deeper questions of what are the real obstacles within ourselves and outside of ourselves that are creating these conditions that we're struggling with. So it's important, you know, they say another world is possible, but you have to actually live something of that other world. You know, you have to actually experience something different in order to give you both the motivation and the desire to continue. Just as an abstract other world to me is not a very strong motivator, as we see. If it was, then, you know, more people would become more active. So anyway, they say such experiences have become far rarer in recent years. Is that true? Is that not true? I don't know. Give us your thoughts. We might here focus on two related developments: preemption and punishment by process. Preemptive tactics are those which stop protests before they start or before they can achieve anything. Kettling, which is basically surrounding a group of demonstrators and keeping them in, and then often arresting them when they try to break through, or even just arresting them on any pretext whatsoever. Mass arrests, stop and search, lockdowns, house raids, and preemptive arrests are examples of these kinds of tactics. Punishment by process entails keeping people in a situation of fear, pain, or vulnerability through the abuse of procedures designed for other purposes, such as keeping people on pre-charge or pre-trial bail conditions, which disrupt their everyday activity, using no-fly and border stop lists to harass known dissidents, carrying out violent dawn raids, needlessly putting people's photographs in the press, arresting people on suspicion, sometimes in accord with quotas, using pain compliance holds, or quietly making known that someone is under surveillance. Once fear of state interference is instilled, it is reinforced by the web of visible surveillance that is gridded across public space and which acts as strategically placed triggers of trauma and anxiety. And of course, you know, there's so many other examples of just, you know, declaring people illegal, you know, illegal immigrants. It puts them in a permanent precarious situation where they're basically punished for their very existence, and on and on. Anecdotal evidence has provided many horror stories about the effects of such tactics. People left a nervous wreck after years awaiting a trial on charges for which they were acquitted, committing suicide after months out of touch with their friends and family, or afraid to go out after incidents of abuse. Of course, you know, constant abuse that the society inculcates in people is just another example of this. The effects are just as real as if the state was killing or disappearing people, but they are rendered largely invisible. In addition, many radicals are also on the receiving end of precarious employment and punitive benefit regimes. We are failing to escape the generalized production of anxiety. If the first wave provided a machine for fighting misery and the second wave a machine for fighting boredom, we now need is a machine for fighting anxiety. And this is something we do not yet have. If we see from within anxiety, we haven't yet performed the reversal of perspective, as the situation has called it, seeing from the standpoint of desire instead of power. Today's main forms of resistance still arise from the struggle against boredom, and since boredom's replacement by anxiety have ceased to be effective. Current militant resistance does not and cannot combat anxiety. It often involves deliberate exposure to high anxiety situations. Insurrectionists overcome anxiety by turning negative affects into anger and acting on this anger through a projectile affect of attack. In many ways, this provides an alternative to anxiety. However, it is difficult for people to pass from anxiety to anger, and it is easy for people to be pushed back the other way due to trauma. We've noticed a certain tendency for insurrectionists to refuse to take seriously the existence of psychological barriers to militant action. Their response tends to be, just do it. But anxiety is a real material force, not simply a spook. To be sure, its sources are often rooted in spooks, but the question of overcoming the grip of a spook is rarely as simple as consciously rejecting it. There's a whole series of psychological blockages underlying the spook's illusory power, which is ultimately an effect of reactive affect. Saying just do it is like saying to someone with a broken leg, just walk. Well, apparently we have a caller on the air. Mark, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that a lot of the anxiety and oppression people are feeling right now are from their word not being heard. And a lot of that's because all our politicians have been bought and sold and owned by corporations. I'm a member of Wolfpack. I'm sure you heard of them.
Actually, I haven't.
You haven't heard of Wolfpack? Well, it's got like 10,000 members across the United States. We're passing Article 5 convention. We've already passed it in California to reverse Citizens United and take the money out of politics. And we have already passed it in Vermont, and Oregon's next.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, and once the politicians can't be bought and sold anymore, their voice will be heard more, because right now all the politicians are answering to their donors, the people that are paying them. They don't really care about what you have to say. In fact, they'd laugh at what we have to say when we're protesting the streets. They know that that's not where their money's coming from. Their jobs aren't hurt by the people shouting in the streets, because they've already getting the money from their donors, the big corporations. And so once this Article 5 convention happens, they will be forced to listen to the people. And it's already passed in California and Vermont, and Oregon's next, so...
Uh-huh. Well, I guess these are all worthwhile efforts. I certainly would not, criticize the efforts per se. I guess the point, what I'm getting at is, from what I see is that, the basic problem is we've got these entrenched structures of power and decision-making heavily influenced by the corporations. We basically live in a corporate state. And so there's this kind of like this nexus, this lock on power and decision-making. And you've identified one major source of that. The problem is, in order to gain the people power, in order to truly confront that, we need also to confront these obstacles within ourselves, which are created by the conditions of society. But we need to also confront that in order to free up the energy of people to engage more. Because 10,000 people is good, but in my opinion is we're going to need a lot more people taking more direct action in order to confront the system of power. So I guess that's the point.
You don't need a lot of people, actually, with the Wolfpack resolution. The whole idea is that it's going state by state. In fact, the one in California was passed with just 30 volunteers, basically 30 to 50 volunteers. So we don't need, all we need is some really people with a lot of conviction and empowerment in themselves. A few is better than a few really strong, motivated people is better than 1,000 or 10,000 so-so motivated people. So each state has a few motivated people. Of course, we could use you too. So if you want to check out Wolfpack, we'd like to have you as a member.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for calling. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Bye.
And we do have another caller. Thomas, you're on the air. Hello?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Fascinating. First, I heard about the zine, and it's very interesting. And my first reaction is that I'm not surprised you're not getting much response. And I think it's sort of a subject that is difficult for people to grasp, to grapple with, because, you know, it does, it hits a little bit close to home, because it hits to how people's fears and how they feel within themselves and how they characterize their sense of responsibility. And, you know, it's interesting to think about the fact that, you know, voting in the United States has largely been reduced to a placebo, unfortunately. And we have a civic model of minimal sort of proceduralized participation. And, you know, people who are otherwise very principled and altruistic in their daily life have sort of been internalized a model of a very passive, individualized model. And then, you know, you have a sense in which the narratives that surround those who are revered, particularly on the left, such as Gandhi and King, the dominant narrative has to do with the passive aspect of what they did, which is the nonviolent aspect. And what's been completely marginalized is the active aspect, the fact that people like Gandhi and King and these luminaries of the left that we celebrate at every opportunity engaged in active resistance and law-breaking, principled law-breaking, and actually did something. So I think it's ironic, too, that you have, you know, you talked about the idea of the boredom and the sort of ennui of the 50s and 60s is you had this baby boomers growing up in this, and also the parents' generation, the so-called greatest generation, sort of lost in materialism. Well, you know, I think it's interesting that we then mythologized after the of course we had the rise of the anti-racism era and the pro-civil rights era and so forth. But it's strange. You think it seems like now what we have is we have this great mythology of this era, and of course at the time in the 60s, the majority of people who now would self-identify with the left never really were that actively participating in the beginning. And so the sense of anxiety you talk about, I think, you know, anxiety is very closely related to the feeling of a passive victim. You know, someone who feels, whether they'll admit it publicly or not, has little control over their personal destiny or social participation. And I think that's exactly the conundrum that the American left finds itself in, that they've been told, you know, they sanctified voting, and so sort of a doubling down. You know, we vote for people that we're told over and over again that that's the mechanism. We celebrate it. We vote for people. The people fail them. We fail to question and do root cause analysis of the structure, because that's the thing that can never be, you know, talked about, really, is what the thought that has to be banished is that it's not just voting for the right people, but the deep structure. But anyway, once this fails us, then there's sort of this absolute withdrawal into despair. Instead of being outraged that our leaders don't do what we do or do the bidding of those who are malefactors in society, who damage our life, we withdraw into this sort of passive victimhood, which serves to maintain this mythology, which maintains these deep structures of the state. And so I think there's just sort of this incredibly this stuckness. You know, you go back to the social theorist Herbert Marcuse in his writing One Dimensional Man, and also Eric Fromm wrote in his book Escape from Freedom. There's a tendency of the human being to shrink from, to want others to come and to help, to want father figures, mother figures to do something. And then, and this is modern people. This is people that are college educated. And when this isn't given to them, then there's this sort of this gulf between, well, I did what I was supposed to do, and this father figure, this mother figure didn't help me, and so now I'm going to withdraw. And I think the ultimate impediment is undergoing this, you know, getting beyond this sense of individual guilt and individual. Actually, I think there's also an element of embarrassment and a sense of pride where people don't want to admit. It takes a step to admit that, that maybe we have to actually do something other than vote. Maybe we have to actually question the deep structure of our society. Maybe we have to question the money that we have in our 401k that's for our retirement. Maybe we have to question the fact that we're voting for people who are, you know. And so I think that's the gulf. I think there's almost a narcissistic, it's not just the anxiety and the passiveness, it's a narcissistic need to maintain a fiction which absolves us from true personal responsibility beside the passive rituals such as voting that have been allowed us. Anyway, those are just some of my thoughts on the subject.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's a lot to put out there. And hopefully you'll stimulate further conversation at 503-231-8187. Are you still there? Oh, he's gone. The whole issue that I've been talking a lot about is the difference between, you know, the personal and the individual and the some kind of group cohesion. Because, I mean, if you look at both, especially Gandhi, but also Martin Luther King, they came out of a culture of solidarity, basically, or a culture where people were had a very strong common oppression and a very strong common identity, a cultural identity. Certainly a lot of the motivation for the early civil rights movement came out of the Black church, certainly came out of the common experiences, the horrible legacy of slavery and Jim Crowism and all that. And obviously the Gandhi movement came out of the common history of colonization and the common culture. Of course, a lot of the problems that ensued in India came out of religious and caste differences and et cetera. But Gandhi tried to address those as well. But so when in the United States, which is kind of like at the, I think we really have to recognize, of course, this came out of the UK, but I think it's very applicable to the United States as well. I mean, it's really a hyper expression of rootless, disintegrated modernity, where we basically have to reconstitute the, you know, social connections as we try to fight the forces that continue to disintegrate those social bonds. It's kind of this fairly overwhelming dual challenge that we have, at least dual. And so why I focus on this, the kind of the psychological aspect, which is because that's where we live our daily lives, and that's where the kind of the personal meets these larger historical forces that we're grappling with. But we do have another caller. Keith, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to agree with the previous caller. I didn't catch the guy's name. I'd love to buy him a beer and sit around and talk about what we all could be doing differently. And I just wanted to support that, what he said. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling. And Ginger's on the air.
Thank you.
Hello.
Yeah. Basically, I just want to appreciate KDU as always. I think that that kind of program is what we need. I think that the anxiety that we feel, and I can say personally, the anxiety I feel today is very deep, and it has to do with the silence of what's going on in Israel and their abuse of the people of color over there, and how the Palestinians are basically being murdered, and the fact that my money, that is my taxes, go there. So to provide all that killing machine, and no one is talking about it. Very few people, and it seems taboo to talk about it. Okay. And so that is an amazing fear, or a fear, and that sense of, like you said, despair, where we don't know. I mean, Facebook is bullshit. It doesn't really give you much of a communication with anybody except what your cat is doing today. But it just seems like we are, as a family of people in this world, being manipulated and used for the purpose of profit for the people that want to basically expand their empire. And that's my 3 cents.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, the whole issue of taboo is what it's all about. The fact that, like, for example, on NPR, the kind of discussion of what's going on in Gaza, the level was very minimal compared to, I think, what goes on over Democracy Now! And flashpoints.
Yeah.
But on a real person.
You think that we have selective Holocaust. My Holocaust is better than yours, kind of thing. And you are right away, if you even question it, you are called anti-Semite, when all those people are Semites. They're not. The Jews are not the only Semites. The Palestine, the whole area, those are all Semites. So it's just so much bullshit with the fall. It just makes me very upset. That's all I can say. And the way that I try to build community for and with people is to sing my music up in the street, and during the summer is what I do. I just have to resist acculturation and resist the fear and resist the sense that I have to be isolated. So we have to be in the streets with music, with positivism, with the sense that we can make a change and support each other and love each other the best way we can. But I just cannot believe how silent we are about the situation in Gaza today.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for those words. I before you go, I just say for those who are listening who may have heard a couple blank spaces, you said a couple words you can't say on the air, and I had to press the dump button.
Okay.
So I would really encourage you not to do that in the future so people can hear everything that you have to say.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. We have a couple more callers. Micah, you're on the air.
Hello. Hey, a lot of the stuff you're talking about is really, really complex, and I've been thinking about a lot of it recently, trying to deal with organizing people, everybody, to deal with these things. And some of my insights I'd like to add is that it's really like a really complex thing. It's like a double-edged sword in the way everybody knows all these things. Everybody lives in this country, and everybody's working and trying to survive, and everybody already experiences all this stuff you've been talking about, and they all know it. And from their experience, they live here. They deal with it every day. And so we don't need to explain it, really, to anybody. Everybody knows this. Even people that you think are completely uneducated know this. I mean, you can talk to homeless people on the streets that seem totally out of their minds, and they know this. You can talk to 10-year-olds, and they know all this stuff you've been talking about. Because everybody, this is the thing everybody deals with every day.
Well,
so
but
you have to kind of...
We may or may not know it fully consciously. You may not be fully aware of it, though.
That too. Yeah. That's another part of the complexity, is that we're not all the same, and everybody experiences it and takes it in a different way. But on the other hand, it is all the same, and everybody does all know it. So it's like not all the same, but it is all the same at the same time. And then, so you don't want to spend too much time on the analysis of it, because it gets to be just around and around in circles, and everybody's, people just start rolling their eyes because they already know. They've been dealing with this the last 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years of their life, and so you have to really kind of be careful on not over spending so much time on the analysis of it all and more time on providing solutions to people, because people already know all this stuff and they want to hear solutions.
Yeah, but I think we have to, the whole thing is we have to come up with collective solutions. So someone providing solutions for someone else may not be the most effective strategy, because the problem of disempowerment is that people delegate authority to decide to other people, whether it's politicians, whether it's de facto by corporations making all the economic decisions for what gets produced, how it gets produced. And so we end up with all these toxic things in our environment, in our bodies. So there, people, that's the problem. We have this, tend to have this sort of unconscious passivity of other people making decisions or providing solutions. So that's why I think, the Occupy movement and other, movements that have arisen, things that I've been involved in are what's really needed. We need to collectively get together. And that's why, we need to, that's why they talk about how real social movements where people really rise up, provide these moments where people directly engage with each other and with, you know, these power structures, and that tends to, you know, tends to shake, to some extent, shake off these psychological obstacles that we all have, you know. But, you know, not everybody has necessarily the time and energy to join a group or whatever. So it's, it is very complex, as you say.
And one idea I have a lot of the time, and I boil it down to just a motto, is we need to have a revolution of the mind, a revolution of our mind. That's not a new saying or anything, but we really do. People need to have a revolution, and also not just their mind, but their expectations. People, just like you're saying, they are always expecting some big group, some big company, some big well-known person, politician, to lead and provide something, or they don't think it's legitimate. If it's something that just some little group over here in the corner of the country, they don't get behind it because it's not big, you know. And so, and they also, there's this brainwash that's all part of the 1% and the ruling elite. What they want you to think is that you can't do anything, that you'll never change anything, it's all too big and all that. And that's all part of the brainwash that you really have to get people to ignore and to overcome and have a revolution of their expectations. We can have major change. There's been major changes throughout all kinds of civilizations, and you have to really convince people. Will shoot down things all the time, say, you can't do that, you can't do that. You have to stop them and say, yes, we can. We can have major, major changes.
I've heard that before. Yes, we can.
Yeah,
sorry.
But it's true, because it's this big brain, and it's all part of the divide and conquer. They want, and then that's another big thing, is the divisiveness. You need to really focus on not arguing with people and try to get people together around, find issues we have in common. Poverty, declining health, education system, health care that's way too expensive, and we're all being gouged by these private companies. Left and right, people will all agree on those things. You need to find the positive things that we can rally around and stay away from the negative things.
Okay, well,
divide everybody, because the divisiveness is really what's stagnating and killing this whole country and keeping the people in charge, in power. And people really need, you need, it's really hard for people, because you get really angry about this issue or that issue, but that's really what's keeping it all the same, is everybody being divided.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to cut you off because we've got a couple more callers and only 7 minutes left. So
thanks
a lot for calling in and sharing your perspective.
Thank you.
Okay. We have another caller. Steve, we have another caller, don't we? Steve. Dave, you're on the air.
Hello, this is Dave.
Hello?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hey, I just came into the listening to it, but the guy about two calls before him, was talking about voting. And I think in this country, we haven't really understood voting or fully used it, and for people to throw it out. And what I mean by that is, when the presidential election comes, there's a certain amount of people that get out there and we're enthusiastic. But as soon as that's done, then that's it. Then the voting, you know, the next time you're in the mid, there's only half the people show up. And you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So when I hear people saying voting doesn't work, it's no use, we've never really fully used it. It's a little bit like Earth Day or something. We'll have Earth Day, and people will come out and pick up trash and plant a tree, and then after that's done, it's like, okay, we did our part, and that's it.
Right. Well, I mean, we need to become the decision makers, ultimately. I think, personally, I feel that representative democracy has inherent flaws. It's basically a result of mass society, and mass society is basically part of the problem that we're dealing with. We have this large anonymous structures, two large structures, centralized structures of power, and so the individual voice just tends to get lost in that. I'm not dismissing any level of voting or anybody's, you know, decision to participate in electoral process, And this is a much deeper conversation we can have in the remaining 5 minutes on the debating, you know, electoral politics and non-electoral politics. But yeah, I mean, that's a little a field from the discussion that I initiated, but I think it's all important.
Can I just say one more thing on that?
Mm-hmm.
We know that there is kind of a Democrat and left or whatever and a right, which is the right is the big corporations. Well, we on the left have always had the numbers. If you look at the situation, the environment, and you ask all the people in the United States, you'll find that majority of the people really are, you know, on the left. They don't know it. And so we have the numbers. It's just that when we start clawing at each other, saying voting doesn't work, it's no use, and various things like that, and trying to split up the left, we're splitting up one of our only real powers we have is our numbers.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Bye.
Appreciate your calling. And we do have one more caller. Elliot, you're on the air.
I think this is a great program, and I don't think it's a coincidence that it's a new program because someone else voluntarily retired from their cable slot. I was, unlike you, I was present at Occupy Portland, and I happened to overhear and watch as a naive young person came up to your volunteer coordinator and asked if they could have a show at cable. If you don't change personnel on a regular basis as a first thing and as a second thing, if you don't bias the selection of on-air personnel to people who have bona fide activist organizational commitments that show real results,
well, that's another
then
big...
you get moribund, ineffective verbiage. And that's why WBAI in New York, which had twice the program gridlock, as you see at Cabo, is going out of business, and all of Pacifica is going to fail because there are Pacifica people who have had their shows for 30 and even 50 years.
Well, I think I feel like you're making some somewhat overgeneralizations, but again, it's a kind of a big topic to get into with 2 minutes left
in
the program.
The right believes in competition, but, so they change personnel. Well, the left creates narcissistic cliques.
Okay. Well, you know, don't want to have too many personal comments on things.
It's unavoidably personal.
Okay. Well, I appreciate...
Because if you don't select new activists preferentially to speak, and if you don't deliberately change personnel because you're only concerned about internal narcissistic politics, then you end up with a lot of either retirees with nothing to do with their time.
Okay, well,
or self-obsessed.
I think you're saying it a little too strongly. I would really take exception to the way you're framing that, but a lot of people have expressed similar sentiments, and I do think that change can be good. And we all need to look at ourselves and to confront things about ourselves and our own organizations. And so all that is taken in the spirit in which you offer it. So thank you very much for calling. My name is Paul Ruins. It's been Wednesday Morning Talk Radio.
Just take your life easy and stop all that hurrying. Be happy my way. Tension starts mounting and you've lost count of the pennies you missed. Just try hard and see why they're not worrying me. The last of my...
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Drones in Oregon, Myths, Facts, and Futures, a community forum about the use of drones. This community forum on the use of drones will take place Thursday, August 7th from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, Southwest 12th and Salmon in Portland. Speakers include retired Army Colonel Ann Wright, Brian Whiteside, Peter Lumsdaine, and Oregon State Representative Jennifer Williamson. Again, that's Drones in Oregon, a community forum on Thursday, August 7th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. More information at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 9 o'clock here at KBOO Portland. It's time for public affairs programming for Wednesday morning. Coming right up on Political Perspectives, we'll hear an episode from The Michael Slate Show about the escalated genocide in Gaza. At 10 o'clock, we'll hear Air Cascadia, headlines, news, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news journalism with your host, Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, it's the KBOO Bike Show. Today, Tori Bortman and friends bring you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. We'd like to extend a big thank you to all you members who are supporting Community Radio KBOO. We really appreciate it. And if you're not a member, you'd like to become one, it's so easy to do. You just go to kboo.fm on the web and click on where it says Donate Today. Thanks for doing that. And we're going to get right to The Michael Slate Show. Thanks for tuning into KBOO today.